Welcome to today's program titled Recent Avoiding Liability and Limiting Exposure Under California's Call, Recording, and Monitoring Privacy Laws. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you're encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. The Q&A will be at the end of the presentation. This presentation has been prepared by Sifar Shah LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during the webinar should not be construed legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendee's verification code will be read during the presentation and will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. If you'd like to download a copy of the presentation, you may do so from the Handouts tab in the conference material pod on the left side of your screen. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. You may begin.
Great. Thank you, and thank you to the audience for joining us today for today's program, Avoiding Liability and Limiting Exposure Under California's Call Recording and Monitoring Privacy Laws. I'd like to introduce you to today's panel. First, we have Joseph Mara. Joseph is an attorney in our Los Angeles downtown office. He's in our Labor and Employment Practice Group and Social Media Group. He has background in general litigation, having represented a variety of corporate clients in federal and state forums and all types and aspects of commercial litigation. He has extensive experience on the counseling as well as the litigation front as it relates to our topic. I'd also like to introduce you to another one of our panelists, Joshua Salinas. He's an attorney in our Century City, Los Angeles office, and he also has a specialty in counseling and litigation as it relates to call recording and call monitoring. He represents clients in complex commercial disputes involving trade secrets and restrictive covenants, as well as consumer class actions. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in the Los Angeles Century City office of Sifar Shah. I'm a member of our Consumer Class Action Defense Group, and I'm also the co-chair of our Trade Secrets and Non-Compete Group. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a very timely and important topic. You may have seen in the news recently plenty of consumer class actions involving call recording and call monitoring, particularly in California. Plaintiff's attorneys are increasingly filing these consumer class actions seeking to apply the state's privacy laws to routine communications between business and their customers. Companies located outside of California are not immune. These privacy laws arguably encompass any call made to or received by someone located in California. If a company records or monitors inbound or outbound telephone calls with customers or employees, it runs the risk of violating California's call recording and monitoring laws, which have become incredibly enticing to the plaintiff's consumer class action bar. Nearly 100 such cases have been filed in the last year, alleging companies have violated the California Invasion of Privacy Act by failing to inform customers that their telephone calls were being recorded or monitored. These class action filings may continue to multiply with consumer privacy concerns and the growing prevalence of call recording and monitoring in daily life. Recent case law has influenced the attractiveness of certain SEPA claims, and companies must take proactive measures to protect themselves against these suits. So essentially, in a nutshell, what we hope to cover today first is Joseph Mara is going to cover the background on the statute, and essentially the two statutes in play, which are 632 and 632.7. He'll tell you about the general health statute, how it works, what are the various penalties. Joshua Salinas will cover some of the recent case law in this area. There's been good cases for the plaintiff's bar. There's been good cases for the defense bar. But what we can say is that there's been a continued increase in the filing of these lawsuits. So until there's a dispositive decision by the California Supreme Court, we expect to see lots more of these type of consumer class actions. And finally, I will address some best practices to protect companies from these particular lawsuits. So we'll provide not just advice with respect to how to deal with these problems and avoid lawsuits, but how to deal with the lawsuits when they come along. With that, I will turn the presentation over to Joseph Mara, and he will get into some of the background on the SEPA statute.
Good morning. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for the introduction, Robert. First off, everyone on the call listening is well ahead of the curve, so congratulations to you. Too many companies are learning about the California Invasion of Privacy Act the hard way, with a lawsuit pending and kind of learning on the fly. Sort of getting out here, doing these kinds of webinars, and learning about the statute helps you just sort of get ahead of the risk and position yourself to either avoid liability or to mitigate it if a lawsuit comes. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is really why these statutes matter. And we'll get to this in a few moments. But when I talk about SIPA, I'm really just talking about sections of Penal Code 632 and 632.7, which respectively prohibit the recording of landline conversations and cell phone conversations. The financial exposure for illegally recording phone calls is quite staggering. It's $5,000 per violation in a civil action. You add on to that someone who's been a victim of illegal call recording can add on a request for injunctive relief, which, as we know, can often be more expensive than paying damages. The two aren't mutually exclusive, and actual damages are not required. So I don't need to show as a plaintiff that I've actually been damaged by the violation. I just show up and I can get my $5,000 and force you to change your practices with a mandatory injunction. And that is something that makes this extremely attractive to the plaintiff's bar. There are set damages. There's no room for negotiation. There's a low threshold for showing that your person has been damaged. And then you've got the boogeyman of injunctive relief hanging out there as well. Another thing that makes SIPA so attractive to the plaintiff's bar is that it's a short, plain, and pretty rigid statutory scheme. It's not something that's really been hashed out too well in the courts. It's written in awfully plain language, which lends itself to a number of interpretations. And there's just not a lot of wiggle room. You get hit with one of these lawsuits, and there are a finite number of arguments you can make. And this is really just a statute that was built to deter and streamline any litigation to enforce it. Another thing to consider here is that there's a one-year statute of limitations, which when you're talking about the one-off phone call that may have been recorded, in a private business setting, that's one thing. But I know many of you on the line work at businesses where thousands of phone calls are coming in every hour, especially in California. And you take that and you extrapolate that out for 365 days in a year at $5,000 a violation, the numbers just start to skyrocket. So the risk here is very tangible. As Robert mentioned before, there were nearly 100 lawsuits filed in California alone in the last year. And the plaintiff's bar is migrating to other jurisdictions as well. I know that there's a class action that's just filed in Washington State. So this is certainly a California based movement, but it's gaining traction outside the jurisdiction as well. And just a quick note on which states outside of California have legislation. You see here in the slide a list of a dozen states. They're in different statuses as far as what their statute says, what cases have interpreted those statutes to mean. And while California is what we're going to talk about today, and Josh is going to talk specifically about the different decisions construing the California statutes, In Illinois, for example, their call recording statute was recently struck down as being unconstitutional, violating the First Amendment because it was just too broad and it essentially prohibited a slew of activity that would have been completely lawful, like recording a public conversation, for example.
And by these statutes, we essentially mean that these are states where they have dual consent requirements so that both parties to the conversation have to consent to call recording and call monitoring. Other states, of course, only have one-way consent. So these particular jurisdictions can be problematic and where you can see actions brought by the plaintiff's bar as a result of not having appropriate consent.
So part of understanding the risk here and kind of how to mold your business's practices to conform with the policy is, what is SIPA? Where did it come from? And what was it really meant to accomplish? SIPA itself, you know, the original statutes are a product of the 1960s sort of wiretapping, constitutional jurisprudential movement to enforce the privacy rights of private citizens. I always think of the Warren Court when I think about SIPA because it is just such an anti-wiretapping piece of legislation. And of course, as technology advanced through the 60s, privacy became increasingly infringed. So ultimately what we have today, which is just a myriad of privacy statutes. So we start in the 1960s with California Penal Code Section 632, which is essentially no monitoring or eavesdropping and no recording of confidential communications. And we'll break down those elements specifically in a few moments. Over time, as cordless technology took off, cell phones and cordless phones, obviously cordless phones, I mean the wireless devices we use in our house on the 900 megahertz type frequencies, I guess now they're on 2 gigahertz, hooked up to an answering machine or something like that, which have grown by leaps and bounds in technology. And then cellular, meaning the wireless communications that communicate with satellites, such as your cellular phone, your smartphone that you use today. And as technology has evolved over the years, sections have been added to SIPA to cover that technology. For example, in 1985, a section was added to prohibit the malicious interception and recording of cellular radio telephone communications. And then in 1991, an additional section was added to deal with of the same malicious interception recording of cordless telephones. So this is, again, just SIPA trying to keep pace with technology. Now, as of the early 1990s, there was a gap in the legislation. If one were to put Section 632 together, that's landline eavesdropping and recording, with the 1985 and 1991 additions, which handled malicious interception recording of wireless communications, there was a gap. Namely, what do you do if you innocently came upon some wireless communications and recorded those? That gap in the legislation was pointed out in 1991 by the Sacramento County District Attorney at the time, Steve White, who wrote a letter to the State Assembly Chamber saying, the problem with the current statutory scheme was recently highlighted in a case where a person used a scanner, came upon a cordless phone conversation between two parties who were business partners discussing a proposed deal regarding a third businessman. Now, the person using the scanner found the conversation interesting, and he taped it without knowing the parties or the full import of the conversation. A friend of the tapers became aware of the tape. He knew the parties to the conversation, and he tried to sell the tape to the third businessman who was being discussed. Now, under the statutes as they existed in 1991, the taper committed no crime. He just stumbled upon a conversation and recorded it. The author of this letter then proposed that the current statutes be left intact and a new statute be added to criminalize the recording of an intercepted cordless or cellular telephone call. To parallel Section 632, the author suggested that the affirmative act of intentionally tape recording a cellular or cordless telephone call would demonstrate enough anti-privacy intent to warrant the criminal sanction, even if malice were not present. This would bring the recording of cellular and cordless phones within the same framework as regular or landline-based calls, but still provide protection for those who use common scanners or cordless phones in an essentially innocent fashion. The result of that gap-filling attempt was the introduction of Section 632.7 in 1992, which is really the engine of the class action litigation that we're seeing today. So if we look specifically at the language of the two sections in play here, 632, landline calls, and 632.7, cellular calls or wireless calls, the language of the statute has a number of elements in here. You've got every person who, and person, of course, includes businesses, not just private citizens. So every person who intentionally and without the consent of all parties, and again, this is pretty clear that it has to be all parties to the conversation, which gives rise to the moniker of two-party consent, to a confidential communication. Confidential communication is specifically defined in the statute. We'll get to that in a moment. By means of any electronic or amplifying or recording device, eavesdrops upon or records the confidential communication, whether the confidential communication is carried on among the parties in the presence of one another or by means of telegraph, telephone, or other device, shall be subject to a criminal penalty of $2,500. If we unpack that, we have a statute where the mens rea is intentional conduct. You have to have at least one party not consenting to the recording or eavesdropping. It has to be a confidential communication. And note the distinction here between eavesdropping and recording. This statute treats them as two separate acts. So I can violate Section 632A by merely eavesdropping. I don't need to record that. If I intentionally, without consent, eavesdrop upon a confidential communication, I have violated Section 632A. I could be liable for a $2,500 criminal penalty for each violation and a $5,000 civil penalty plus potential injunctive damages for eavesdropping or replying on that call. The great big wiggle room in Section 632A is defined in Section 632C. It is what defines a confidential communication. And this is really the part of the statute that takes me back to the Warren Court. It's basically, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the topic of the conversation? At least that's how I think of it in my head. And this confidential nature of the communication is one of the things that sets it apart from the later statutes. And it's also something that is the antidote to a lot of class action litigation, as Josh is going to discuss later. The confidentiality or not of a conversation is one of the many factual issues that will raise individual topics of proof in any class action litigation. Now, the more recent statute, the 1992 632.7A, is directed specifically not at landline communications, but as you can see, the litany of combinations laid out in the statute, cellular and cordless communications, cellular and landline, cordless and landline, cordless and cordless, cellular and cellular, every other combination you can think of that 632A doesn't cover, now 632.7 comes in and says, without the consent of all parties, you intercept or receive and intentionally record. This is different than the scheme that's set out in 632A, where eavesdropping or recording would both get you liability. Under 632.7A, intercepting or receiving has nothing to do with it. You somehow come into be a party to this conversation, and without consent to everybody else, you intentionally record it. So 632.7, as we saw in the district attorney's letter, is really aimed at this very narrow gap of intentional recording, regardless of how the material came into the possession of the person. But it also follows the same damages scheme as 632A, with a $2,500 criminal penalty, $5,000 civil penalty, potential of injunctive relief. And as you can see, there's not a whole lot to that statute. There are a few elements, and if you meet them, you're likely to be found liable for violating it. Again, not to steal Josh's thunder, but the consent element and the intentional recording requirements of 632.7A are the ones that really come out in class action litigation. Because when you have a class of 100,000 people, consent is going to vary, and it's going to be an individualized issue.
And there's some novel arguments being made now that are taking the position based upon the legislative history that this particular statute only applies where it's a third party who intercepts the intercepts and records the call. So it would not be the two parties to the conversation. And that's something that some courts have rejected, but it hasn't been dispositively ruled upon by a higher court with respect to how far this goes and who it applies to.
So just to kind of encapsulate those two differences, just so that you have a primer for the two statutes that Josh is going to be discussing in a moment. 632 is our 1967 Civil Rights era privacy statute. It requires non-consensual eavesdropping or recording. It involves landline communications. And the communications that it protects are confidential communications. In contrast, 632.7 is a product of the 90s with cell phones and cordless phones. Again, it requires non-consensual, intentional recording of any communication. The communication need not be confidential. And with that, I'll turn it over to Josh to talk about the recent developments in CIPA.
Thanks, Joe. So we've seen some recent cases that have benefited both the plaintiffs and defendants. With this recent case that just came out of the Ninth Circuit, it seemingly reaffirmed some of the existing California decisions concerning the lack of a confidential communications requirement for 632.7. And as we saw in the previous slide with those landline communications under 632, you have that additional requirement for establishing that there was a confidential communication. And so there is a difference between proceeding under claims under each statute. So in this case, in Young's, the plaintiff consumer had brought a class action under both sections 632 and 632.7 against the defendant hotel company, alleging that the company purportedly recorded his telephone calls to the hotel reservation line and recorded these calls without his consent. And so after removing the case to federal court, Hilton moved to dismiss, arguing that the calls to the reservations line were not confidential communications subject to sections 632 and 632.7, specifically because the callers could not reasonably expect that these calls would not be overheard or recorded. Specifically, they didn't have a reasonable expectation that it would be confidential. And the district court actually agreed and dismissed both claims on grounds that the consumer had failed to allege that his calls with the company were confidential. And the consumer appealed, but appealed only the section 632.7, the wireless claim. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the district court's ruling and held that section 632.7 does not require that the recorded or monitored calls to be confidential to state a claim. The court explained that 632.7 prohibits the recording or monitoring of calls involving cellular or cordless phones, but there's no requirement that the communications actually be confidential. And in explaining this, the court cited the Supreme Court's holding in Flanagan versus Flanagan, which also stated that a confidential communication in order to state a claim under 632.7 does not need to be confidential. And kind of expressly stating that the Ninth Circuit said that in Flanagan, it really forecloses the hotel company's argument that 632.7 should be interpreted as including a confidentiality requirement, because if you have these two statutes, 632.7 and 632, it could lead to absurd results. And then also in the holding, the court, there were some statutory interpretation arguments raised by Hilton, but the Ninth Circuit found that those were purportedly not effectively raised at the lower court and had essentially been waived. So we see with Young, there's this reaffirmation that there's a preceding claims under each statute, that there's no confidential requirement for 632.7 claims. And so this decision demonstrates that companies may have more difficulty dismissing claims under 632.7 as opposed to 632 because of this extra hurdle, this extra requirement of confidentiality. And so, there have been some arguments made that, possibly Young may conflict with some of the legislative intent of the statute regarding whether the statute applies to simple call observations or training observations. But the case reemphasizes really the need for companies to obtain clear consent if calls are being recorded. The decision is also pretty noteworthy. It has a really good analysis in the dissent regarding the legislative history of SIPA, but also raises some additional issues and some unresolved issues that may potentially be subject to further litigation down the line. Specifically, the dissent raised the argument of there's this service observing exception under SIPA, and there may be an exception for when calls are recorded or monitored for these service observation purposes. The dissent also noted that prior to 632.7, SIPA had an exception for the use of any instrument, equipment, facility, or service pursuant to the tariffs of a public utility. Some courts have, however, rejected this argument of whether these companies sometimes may satisfy the status of a public utility. But nonetheless, this case has been remanded back to the district court, and we understand Hilton has filed their motion to dismiss. I think it's a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And there's a couple significant arguments that are being made, and we're going to track this case closely. Three of the kind of big arguments that are being made are, one, whether SIPA has this express exemption for service observations based on the allegations of the complaint. Also, as Robert had previously mentioned, whether 632.7 applies to recordings by just the participants, or whether there's this extra issue with third parties. But one issue that is kind of interesting is actually the aggregation of damages. And this is one of the reasons why SIPA has been very attractive for companies who, or for plaintiffs who say that if companies are recording hundreds or thousands of calls with a $5,000 damage violation, if it's per violation, it can add aggregate to a significant amount. And so the issue, whether these damages should be aggregated or whether there's a floor, it's an interesting issue that hasn't been dispositive or decided yet by our higher court. One of the issues, if you look at the statutory language, the text suggests that the statutory penalty should be capped at $5,000 per lawsuit, and there's no express language that it's $5,000 per violation as opposed to per lawsuit or per action. The text does indicate that a plaintiff is only entitled to recover more if they suffer actual damages, or if those exceed $5,000 alone, or there's also a treble damages provision. But there's nothing we've seen in the legislative history that appears to support an intent that penalties would be on a per violation basis. And looking at it, it appears that the legislature intended for the real deterrent to be that threat of treble damages, of triple damages. It was also further contemplated that repeated violations could be civilly remedied by means of injunctive relief and not the accrual of penalties. The interpretation of this is also, it makes more practical sense when you look at when these damages provisions were enacted. It was about, I think, $3,000 in 1967. And if you look at that amount now, it would probably be about over $20,000 per violation. So at least with the aggregation of damages issue, there's a good faith argument that can be made. And it likely should be made in litigation to at least preserve that issue for future appellate review.
And the interesting thing about the Hilton case, and the case number for that is 212-CV-01788, and it's currently pending in the Central District of California, is that there was also a number of constitutional arguments that were made, and it'll be interesting to see how Judge Real addresses those. This is a case that people that follow the call recording, call monitoring laws are closely following. One of their constitutional arguments was that applying California's law to Hilton's recordings would violate the Commerce Clause because businesses in other states would have to conform to the plaintiff's interpretation of California statutes. Hilton doesn't operate a call center in California, according to the memorandum. And also, the other constitutional argument was that the request for aggregated $5,000 statutory penalties per claim, Hilton argued that it was an astronomical figure bearing no relation to any actual harm, and that the penalties would constitute an excessive fine without due process. So as Josh mentioned, these are very interesting arguments that we're closely following, and it'll be interesting to see how the court decides.
Now, defendants in these cases have not been without, any help as well. We've seen some recent favorable decisions, specifically which have helped with the defenses against class certification. The first one, which we're going to discuss, is Torres versus Nutrisystem, which was recently here in the Central District of California. And the case was brought alleging that Nutrisystem had allegedly violated California Penal Sections 632 and 632.7. In that case, the plaintiff had argued that the Nutrisystem had secretly recorded confidential cell phone conversations that she had with the company. And in that case, during the class period, there were some arguments that Nutrisystem actually was recording these calls. But one of the significant issues was there was a disclaimer provided, an automatic disclaimer at the beginning of some of these inbound calls, but it was bypassable. And so many consumers have become kind of impatient or realized by calling these various customer service lines, pressing zero or pressing anything sometimes can bypass those recordings and get you to an operator. So in this case, there was a bypassable disclosure button that could be to hit at the initial welcome message. And in this case, the court declined class certification, findings that the plaintiff had not met the commonality requirements and the predominance requirements to get class certification under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23 A and B3. With commonality with these classifications, you need to have established commonality, which is essentially that there's common questions of law and fact, and for predominance, that those common questions of law, in fact, predominate over the individual individual differences. And the thrust of the court's ruling in this case was, that the disclosure during the welcome message kind of undermined the commonality of the class and raised these individualized issues as to whether the putative class members had an actual objectively reasonable expectation of privacy or consented to the recording. This case, which looked at 632 regarding that confidentiality requirement, whether there was an objectively reasonable expectation, it was undermined by these individualized issues as to whether and when the class members heard a disclosure, the impact of the disclosure it may have had on their expectations or consent, and so you really had these uncommon individualized issues. And so the court suggested that also the commonality and predominance may be lacking even absent the disclosure issue. For example, the court hinted that common issues may be lacking given that it is well known that businesses may record customers' communications with their customer service representatives and that certain customers may therefore expect that their calls are recorded even absent a disclosure that the call could be recorded. The court also stated that even if customers had an expectation of confidentiality, that these individualized issues may arise for the trier of fact, who would still need to determine if such an expectation was objectively reasonable, which would turn on these idiosyncratic facts such as the length of the class member's relationship with the company or any prior interactions with the defendant. And so although the commonality prerequisite was not met, the court also found that the plaintiff had not satisfied Rule 23b2, which allows for class treatment to get injunctive declaratory relief. It would not apply to the class generally, specifically because the provision was not satisfied because the issue had essentially become moot. Nutrisystem had reconfigured its system, its welcome message, so that disclosure, that disclaimer, could not be bypassable, and therefore it was not likely to allow the disclosure to be bypassed in the future. This case, which we've seen, was holding echoed in the Tatsisihi versus First American case, which also, again, looked at the ability and sometimes the difficulty for plaintiffs to get class certification under 632. as we see, as we previously discussed with confidentiality, you need to have this objectively reasonable expectation that the conversation is not being overheard or recorded. And, that determination sometimes involves individualized proof of the length of that customer's relationship, the prior experiences with the company, and also the prior experiences that plaintiff may have with other companies. And this was illustrated most recently in the case that came out of the California State Court of Appeals, specifically regarding these individualized issues. In the case, the company First American issued these one-year home warranty plans for home appliances, for home systems, and it had these warranties pretty much nationwide for a majority of states. I believe it was about 46 states, which included California. And the customers could make their warranty claims by calling this 1-800, 1-800 customer line. And First American made calls as well, made outbound calls to the customers. So there was both calls coming in and then also calls going out. But all calls, regardless of whether they were inbound from the customer or outbound from the company, were recorded. The inbound calls purportedly had an automated disclosure, but the issue was the outbound calls did not have a disclosure, and allegedly First American did not have a policy or a requirement in place that the call representatives who were making these outbound calls were giving a disclaimer, were orally giving this disclosure to each of the consumers. And so in this case, the plaintiff had purchased a one-year warranty and renewed it annually, and during that relationship with the company had made several calls to the company and admittedly had made about 12 inbound calls, which she received in per this automated disclosure. The plaintiff also admitted that she participated in about a dozen other telephone calls with other companies who had customer service lines that also gave her a disclaimer that her call could be recorded or monitored for quality assurance. And kind of one of the interesting or I guess notable facts was that the plaintiff had not objected to any of those prior disclaimers or disclosures. And so in this case, the plaintiff had received outbound calls from First American in a period between 2008 and 2009, which was discovered. They were recorded, and she purportedly did not receive a disclaimer or notice that it was being recorded. So she filed a class action complaint in Los Angeles Superior Court against First American for claims under CIPA, but specifically for 632, not 632.7. And looking for a motion to certify this class, the court, as it did previously in the Nutrisystem case, denied the certification, finding that there were not common issues of law and fact. The plaintiff had argued that there actually were common issues based on the fact that First American was the only defendant. The policy was to record all outbound calls. The outbound calls did not have an automated disclosure. And First American also did not have a policy requiring those salespersons to give the disclosure. But the court denied the motion for class certification, findings that the individual issues did predominate. It also rejected plaintiff's contention that the subjective reasonableness of each plaintiff's expectations could be assessed by First American's uniform call recording procedures. On appeal, the California Court of Appeal affirmed, explaining that communication is confidential for purposes of Section 632 if there's that objectively reasonable expectation. But in this case, it was not satisfied because plaintiff could not prove that those objective reasonable expectations were the same among all class members, and specifically looked at the individualized proof that would be different regarding the length of the customer relationship, the prior experiences with the company, and the experiences with other companies. And as we've seen with this plaintiff, she had some significant experience with receiving these disclosures from others. So this case does help defeat, is a good defense for class certification, but one of the things to note is that it looks, it involves 632, not 632.7. And so as Joe and Robert previously discussed, there is that ability to attack the class certification issues when you have when you're attacking the confidentiality communications requirement. But nonetheless, many companies, you know, want to avoid getting to litigation in the first place. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Robert Milligan, who will discuss some of the best practices and strategies for avoiding liability and limiting exposure. But first, I'll give you guys the CLE credit. So the code for CLE will be SS1181. That is S as in Sam, S as in Sam, 1181. Robert.
Thanks, Josh. So I'd like to cover what my time is to talk about some general strategies for avoiding liability and limiting exposure. And what a company needs to do is assess their business and see where, you know, where are they currently recording and monitoring telephone calls and whether it's something that's necessary for their business to do. It may be that they're in retail and that they, you know, sell products online and that it's necessary to have a customer service line. It may be that they sell automobiles and they have a customer service line, you know, to field questions. The monitoring and recording of telephone calls by corporations in the United States is very common. And part of the reason the calls are monitored and recorded is for quality assurance, essentially two prongs. One, to making sure that the customer is having a good experience, and then also for monitoring the employee to make sure that the employee is performing up to expectations. And that's why there's a lot of resonance with the legislative history on 632.7 as far as the service observer exception, that meaning that there has always been a purpose for the monitoring and recording of telephone calls so long as it's for a business justification. So it's important whether you're facing, you know, a demand letter or a lawsuit, or you want to avoid a demand letter or a lawsuit, to critically think about your business and do an inventory of whether, you know, whether you are recording inbound and outbound calls, and, you know, what portion of your business is in a state that has dual consent requirements. And obviously, we're talking about California, but as Joe indicated, there's been other class actions in Washington State, and there's other states over 10 that have dual consent requirements. And so you could also be facing, you know, class action lawsuits in those states as well. So it's important to get a handle on where your customers are, where these calls are coming from, so that you can decide whether or not, you know, you really want to record and monitor these calls, or if you want to change your practices. Oftentimes, having done a number of these cases, and working with some of the call center leaders, they obviously recognize the value in monitoring and recording so that the customer gets a good experience and that the employee improves their customer service skills. So you have to really gauge with your company, the call service function, you know, whether or not they really see value in the monitoring and recording. Oftentimes, my experience has been that they do. Another thing is that there may be real practical limitations on, you know, what you're willing to do as far as compromising. It may be that just as a general rule that you've decided that you are going to, on sort of a 50-state basis, continue to monitor and record telephone calls for quality assurances. And if you do take on that, perspective, then you need to also think about some of the technological limitations, because, you know, backup tapes can fill really quick. And, you know, these tapes can be constantly overwritten. So certainly if you're in active litigation, you need to keep that into account as far as suspending your normal, deletion policy and your securing the backup tapes. And it's a consideration to keep in mind. It also, from a counseling perspective, if you're not in litigation and there's been no imminent threat of litigation, it may also be something to keep in mind as far as whether or not you really want to be keeping these records. There may be other regulatory concerns that require you to keep certain records, but from the call recording, call monitoring perspective, you may have an incentive not to be keeping a lot of these records unless required by law. It's also a good time to dust off your retention policies and your retention capabilities and see what are you guys doing in this front? What is your company doing in this front? And what can you do to try to manage and manage the risk there? It's important to be proactive, and nobody wants to obviously pay for an audit product, but it's very important because these cases are, you know, spreading like wildfire, And it's not a matter of if, it's probably more a matter of when, if you don't have a compliant call recording, call monitoring program and system, it's just a matter of when you're going to get targeted and hit with one of these demand letters or class action lawsuits. So why wait? It's time now to determine what your practices are, determine whether calls are being recorded, determine whether you have appropriate disclaimers and disclosures. And we can get into some model language as far as what you should have as far as your disclaimers. Other key considerations are, who's your point person within the call center that's responsible for the monitoring and recording function? What type of software are you using for recording and monitoring? What does your phone tree look like as far as disclaimers go? When somebody first calls in, are they immediately provided with a prompt that's not bypassable that explains that the call could be monitored or recorded for quality assurance purposes? Or is it bypassable? Or is there no disclaimer whatsoever? Are there portions where on the directory tree that if somebody were to sort of jailbreak the phone tree and avoid the disclaimer, is there other portions where the phone tree where they would be provided disclaimer? Or are you sort of more of an old school company that provides sort of an oral disclaimer? We've seen that in some instances. It's important that you have somebody dedicated within your company to be responsible for this, whether it's your compliance officer or whether you're just in charge of consumer class action litigation and you're troubleshooting different areas and sensitive spots within your company where you want to avoid future lawsuits. This is an area where it's important to have a point person that's evaluating the various processes that you have in place for compliance. And the key thing is that one of the best ways to do it is to have a non-bypassable disclaimer so that it's electronically embedded into your phone system so that as soon as the customer calls in, they get the disclaimer. But it's important that if you're not, don't have that technology or you don't have that capability, but you still are recording and monitoring telephone calls, that you make sure that your personnel are trained on providing the appropriate disclaimer. It's important that this is somewhere where companies often don't realize, but it doesn't just apply to inbound calls. It also applies to outbound calls. So it's not just your customer service line where they're receiving calls from customers. It also applies when your customer service reps are reaching out to customers or other third parties and recording their calls. So sometimes we'll see that companies actually have a disclaimer in place for their inbound calls, but it's also applies to the outbound calls. So you need to evaluate your processes that are in place there and make sure that you have a appropriate disclaimer. Oftentimes people ask me, well, what's an appropriate disclaimer? And the case that you often go back to is the necessary consent is defined in this Kearney case where it says, a business that adequately advises all parties to a telephone call at the outside of the conversation of its intent to record the call would not violate the provision. So you can obviously see from that language that it's important to do it at the outset of the conversation before the recording takes place. And that's another key thing to evaluate in your processes is, yes, you may be recording and monitoring calls, but at what point does the recording and monitoring start? Because if you're not recording and monitoring, then you obviously wouldn't be held liable under the statute. So it's important to figure out when in the process you actually do record and monitor. And for those unfamiliar with monitoring is sort of when the over-the-shoulder supervisor is listening in on calls to make sure that the customer service rep is doing it correctly and for quality assurances and training. They may log into the call, but again, and particularly with the confidential communication requirement under 6632, that would need to be disclosed as well with a disclaimer. So a sample disclaimer, and there is obviously some magic language, but I don't think there's anything magic with respect to this. Some of the words are optional and can be fine-tuned, but a sample disclaimer that I think rises to the level of being, you know, market, and that is up to snuff, would be that this and any future inbound and outbound calls may be monitored and or recorded. You could add in, you know, for quality assurance or quality monitoring purposes, but then you're basically holding you're holding yourself to that, but that's the only purpose that they're going to be used for. If they were to be used for other purposes, you may run up to against an argument that your consent was not properly obtained because you didn't fully disclose what you were going to use it for. Here, there's no qualifier that's basically telling the caller that they're going to be called, monitored, and or recorded, and doesn't state what the purpose is. And the additional language that the company will infer or the company will acknowledge that you consent to such monitoring and or recording by continuing your call. The whole point of the disclaimer is that basically you're putting the party on notice, and if they're going to continue the call, that'll be viewed as consent directly or indirectly. It's important, as I indicated, that the disclaimer be played as early as possible in the phone tree. I like to hear it right off the bat when the caller first calls in, you know, that the company identifies themselves, and then the disclaimer is played. And it, again, it's very important. Oftentimes we'll have clients that say, oh yeah, we have a disclaimer, you know, this demand letter or you know, lawsuit is frivolous. And then we say, well, but is it bypassable? And they say, well, what do you mean by that? And I say, well, if somebody presses zero, can they get rid of the disclaimer? And they said, well, yeah, actually it could. Well, in that case, you're getting into that gray area where it may not be so easy to get rid of the lawsuit. So it's much better practice to make sure that it's non-bypassable, and that's very easily done by modern technology. And it's important that oftentimes we'll get questions, well, if they hear it once, isn't that enough? They don't want to have the disclaimer for multiple different lines. And my word of advice is always, the more the better. The more disclaimers you have, the better, because it can only protect you. And it's not uncommon for the plaintiff's bar to get a hold of all your customer service numbers. Say you have 50 customer service numbers. And that's real. I mean, many companies have different various customer service lines for different purposes. And they may have some legacy lines that are still out there that are in function but don't have the disclaimer. So that's part of your identification process, is to come up with the different lines that are used for a customer service function, all the different lines that are used on monitoring and recording, and to make sure that you do have the appropriate disclaimer, and that you get the disclaimer before any recording commences. That's often a question that comes up is, you know, we start recording the whole call, but when we get to the customer service agent, that's when they get the prompt. Now, that's not ideal. I mean, that they may have some wiggle room there about that not being actionable, but the best practice would be that you don't start the recording until the disclaimer is played. I think some emerging areas here is the language question, and what if you know that your consumers, your customers, your California residents, what if you know that they do not speak English? How can you infer that they got consent by having your disclaimer? I think that's an emerging area here. And so what we often say in this instance is that if you do have Spanish-speaking customers, you should have some sort of mechanism that allows them to get the disclaimer in Spanish if this caller requests Spanish language on his or her call. And this may be overkill, and some companies feel just content with having the disclaimer, and that's enough, because, you know, what we've seen is from the, you know, customer service perspective, they want to basically get into the call, help the customer out, and these disclaimers and notices are a lot of noise that costs money and costs time. And so they want to get the minimally compliant disclaimer and move on. And I understand that. Some companies want to have sort of the bells and whistles and make sure that there's no shadow of doubt. So they'll not only have a disclaimer, but they'll also have the customer service rep notify the caller that their call may be monitored or recorded. That's particularly the case where they may not have the software to embed a prompt that a call may be monitored or recorded for an outbound call. They may not have the technology that when they call out that the customer receives a prompt, electronic prompt, that the call could be monitored or recorded. So in that instance, we've seen practically that's where an instance where the customer service rep would actually provide the disclaimer themselves. But that's where in training is very important, because you need to make sure that you have consistent messaging and consistent training so that each customer service rep is providing the same, you know, disclaimer. There's also opportunities, litigation climate and this, you know, plaintiff's counsel trying to basically get their next Learjet on the back of your company. There's an opportunity to basically fend off these type of lawsuits by providing disclaimers all over the place, as far as whenever you're interacting with customers, to try to nip this in the bud. While we wait to see these cases shake out, and hopefully some courts to be rational about this and, get rid of these lawsuits and recognize them for what they are, which are sort of just frivolous shakedown lawsuits. But the recommendation would be that wherever you're interacting with your customers, to use it as an opportunity to provide a disclaimer that their outbound and inbound calls may be monitored or recorded for quality assurance purposes. That can be in emails, that can be in contracts, that can be bills, it can be on your website, other notices to customers. You may want to even bold or highlight the disclaimer so that it's well known. So the bottom line is that if you ever have to face one of these lawsuits and there's an issue about consent or notice, you can point to not only your call system and your call tree, but you can also point to regular communications you had with customers regarding this particular issue. Some companies that are gun-shy and basically want to avoid all risk on call monitoring and call recording have opted to essentially not do it, not call monitor and not call record, at least within the states that have the dual consent requirements. And that's certainly an option. You get a lot of pushback on that as far as companies that see real value in monitoring and recording, particularly to provide better service for their customers and better training for their employees. But you can do a flat prohibition, or you could also just isolate those states in which they have the dual consent. But that's ever so challenging, and that's sort of another real emerging area in this area of law, is what is a California telephone call? Is it that it has a California area code? Is it that somebody calls from California? That's an area where it's still being defined under the law. Certainly there's case law that says that the statute is designed to protect California citizens. And so does that mean if somebody's traveling from, you know, Minnesota to California and their call happens to be recorded while they're in California, that the California law applies? Possibly not also. So it's important to be very critical as far as if you're going to come up with a no call policy or no record policy, that you critically think about, you know, whether you want to have a flat prohibition or you want to isolate particular states, but then you have to take into account the realities of, you know, cell phone communications, and that a caller from California may not really be a California resident and vice versa. Another option would be just to do a sampling of recording of calls from the dual consent jurisdictions instead of recording and monitoring all calls with customers, just to do a sample set of calls so that you can basically know that your rep is providing good service, as well as know that your employee is performing their job correctly. Some other strategies on the slide, if you have contracts with customers, that's where another opportunity where you could provide them notice that calls may be monitored or recorded. It's also an opportunity, you know, the best way to avoid class action lawsuits is to have an arbitration provision. So that may be difficult in the consumer context, but certainly amongst business clients and even consumers, if it's appropriate and you do have, you know, regular communications and regular contracts with your clients, with your customers, you may want to put it in a consumer class action arbitration provision so that you can try to avoid class action lawsuits. But at a minimum, you should make sure that you have some disclaimers in those contracts and communications Another creative strategy is to have a choice of law provision. So take yourself outside these dual consent jurisdictions and take yourself to a jurisdiction where only one party consent is required. That is a viable strategy. There was a recent case where a Missouri resident brought a lawsuit in California under the California statute, and the court did a choice of law analysis and said that Missouri law should apply rather than California law. So there's some options that you have there. Also, put these terms on your website. That can help you. Manage the risk here. And I know we're running low on time, but finally, take into account if you're outsourcing the call recording, call monitoring function, deal with appropriate contractual provisions. So if you are an outsourcing company, try to shift the risk to the company. If you're the company, try to shift the risk to the outsourcing provider to deal with potential liability. The other thing to keep in mind is think about having insurance coverage for these type of claims and see if, in fact, your commercial liability policy does, in fact, cover it. And if it doesn't, try to negotiate for a specific policy or an additional endorsement so that you can get not only defense but indemnity. These claims can be expensive, particularly if you have to litigate. There was a recent settlement of a class action call recording, call monitoring lawsuit down in San Diego, and the settlement was over $11 million. So it's well worth having insurance for these particular types of risks. We invite you to go to our consumer class action website and our blog. We regularly follow SEPA cases, and so we regularly blog on SEPA cases. Thank you so much for attending today's webinar. You will be getting a copy of the PowerPoint presentation, and there's an article that the panel recently did for Law 360 that we'll be sharing with the audience as well. And then we'll also be sharing with you some best practices, best tips about how to protect yourself. So be looking for that in your emails. Looks like we have time for just one or two quick questions. Joe, based upon your experience, what do you think, the question is, if a company could do just one thing to protect themselves in this call recording, call monitoring space, what would you recommend the company do?
Take a good look at their disclaimers, update that disclaimer, and poster it everywhere they can, everywhere they interact with their clients, their customers.
And another question for you, Josh. Do you have any predictions or expectations as far as the case law in California and where it may be heading on call recording, call monitoring? The question basically says, because it looks like you've said there's some good cases for the plaintiffs, some good cases for the defendants. Any sort of predictions about where the law is heading or whether this legislative history argument may get some traction?
I think as we previously discussed, the Hilton case that is now back in the district court is probably going to be one of the leading cases to follow. Probably the emerging trend we're going to see with these cases is it's becoming a lot more difficult to get class certification with these individualized issues for Section 632 cases. So we expect to see, and we have started seeing a lot more cases that are based on 632.7. And so we think that a lot of the emerging issues are really going to be coming out of the cellular phone and wireless cases.
Thank you, Josh, and thank you to the audience. Feel free to reach out to your panelists if you have any further questions or concerns. We'd be happy to field any of those. And again, follow our blog for the latest updates on these invasion of privacy claims. Have a great day.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.